ॐ ज्ञानचन्द्रस्य धनञ्जनाशलाकय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. पञ्चकौपाथरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभयेभ्य च पतितानां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. Just a side note, I'm sorry a little bit late, but today is the disappearance, the death anniversary of Sriman Jayananda Prabhu, a godbrother of mine, who is, Srila Prabhupada himself should be put on the calendar so his day is remembered. I was going to speak a little bit about him, but I'm a little bit late. But really main quality is that, I had some association, some meeting with him when I first came to spiritual life in 1970. In San Francisco. Wow. Was that 39 years ago? You know, I saw him and I just remember his humility, never wanting to put himself in the center, which is one of the key symptoms of spiritual life in any path, that the spiritual aspirant is free from egoism. And the symptom of freedom from egoism is the desire to always see oneself as the object of service for God and others, and not to see others as the object of service for oneself. Even though he was such a prominent member of the Krishna Bhakti movement, whenever Prabhupada would come, even though he's so prominent, Prabhupada finally would have to ask, where is Jayananda? Because he was always just engaged in some humble service. So it's nice to remember him today. So just a little summary. Although we only covered, this is the 15th verse, these are some of the longest purports. So actually in the book, it's hundreds of pages. In the sutras. And we're still in the definition of yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Discussed yoga as quelling the mind, equanimity of the mind. Yoga, chitta, we describe what is the nature of that mind, the chitta. And then we just finished the section on vritti, or the fluctuations of the mind. Now, beginning in verse 12, we began to discuss what is nirodha, the restraint of the mind. So what is nirodha? What is the control or restraint of the mind? And it discussed that the vrittis, these states of mind, they're restrained by how they're restrained, how the vrittis are restrained, nirodha, by practice and detachment. And as in the general form of Pantanjali discussing these sutras, he gives the definition and then he expands it. So he says, okay, what is this nirodha, the restraint, or how is the vritti restraint? What is the how is it restraint? The discussion of Nirodha restraint. It's restrained by practice and detachment. So that practice and renunciation, practice and detachment. That's a classical sutra, a very short definition. And then practice is discussed in verses 13 and 14, and then today's 15th verse will discuss what is vairagya or renunciation. So classic, the verse. And the vritti, the fluctuations, they are checked by this this passion, which is based on discrimination. When you have a lack of discrimination, when you don't understand deeply when you don't understand deeply the results of attachment, then the grittis, they flow towards externally, towards whim and vice. So he first describes what is this practice, and the practice is to be situated in one pointedness. This the practice is this effort. This effort to be focused the mind, to be situated in one pointedness. And that effort is defined as some enthusiasm based on understanding and some vigor. That's the practice of yoga. And then finally it's discussed how can that practice achieve this steadiness, this vigor, and this enthusiasm to make it one pointed. How can it achieve it? And then finally, it describes that that it becomes established when it is cultivated uninterruptedly. First thing is without interruption. If you have a japa meditation or a silent meditation or whatever your meditation is, which is the practice to control the fluctuations of the mind, the first thing is without interruption. You can't take break periodically at whim. There's asana, there's a seat. I actually now, after reading this and also just understanding basically, you know, practice, I travel so much. Now I travel with a seat. I travel with an asana. And that asana represents to me, when I sit on that asana, then my meditation continues without interruption. It does not break for whim. And what's the whim? Any of the fluctuations of the mind. That's what yoga means, to control that. So if you're going to sit down and practice, it's difficult. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says it's more difficult to control the mind than the raging wind. The mind is like the raging wind, but it's possible by practice and detachment. So this practice is this focus of the mind with vigor, with enthusiasm. So how do you achieve that steadiness when there are distracting memories and tendencies inherited from time? It's a question which all aspiring yogis must consider. How can I achieve this steadiness when we're actually practicing yoga? The first thing is without interruption. You cannot take break periodically. When you sit down with your objective of the time you're going to meditate, you have to do without interruption. No phone, no fax, no computer, no family, no books, and ideally no distracting memories. And the second thing is, how do you achieve this steadiness, dirghakala, for a long time? You can't expect to attain success in a few months or even after many years unless you're exceptionally, exceptionally dedicated. You have to commit yourself to the practice and it's science. And if one does that, one achieves steadiness and that effort to be situated in one pointness of mind becomes successful. Can't attain it in a half-hearted, it's the topmost and ultimate goal of life. That's why it's so important to actually hear with faith. That's the purpose of Shastra. Shastra means revelation. And when one has faith in that revelation, by hearing and hearing, his faith increases. His faith increases. And that's one of the main ways that one prevents the mind from becoming overwhelmed. When he has faith or conviction, you have faith or conviction, and that comes by hearing. That's why we're hearing now these Yoga Sutras, and I think that's why it's also important. Because when you hear regularly from a authoritative thought, and you're applying that knowledge you hear from that authoritative source, so it becomes somewhat realized, you develop faith. And faith prevents you from becoming overwhelmed by these distractions and memories, because of the terminating, it's not immediately overwhelmed. You have some chance. Of course, he mentions also, faith is based on knowledge, practicing austerities also quells the mind. Austerity means despite the irrational impulses of the mind, you become fixed on your will and duty. So this is what was discussed, this practice. Now, in today's verse, now that they discussed abhyas, or practice, now they'll discuss vairagya, or renunciation. So this is the definition that's given. Renunciation is the controlled consciousness of one who is without craving for sense objects, whether actually perceived or described in the Vedas. So it's renunciation here is described as not just staying aloof from the objects of the senses, but coming to the platform of being indifferent to them. And sequential, according to Vidyan Bhikshu, one of the commentators, he says the practice leads to this point. And this point leads to the meditational state of samadhi. Unless you come to the platform of indifference, you can't have that level of meditation, which is actually yoga or the perfection of yoga. So after defining practice, now the second element, this vairagya, this restraint of the mind. And absence of craving for sense objects, sex life, power, revenge, food, wealth, no craving. That's when you actually come to vairagya, when you actually come to indifference. There's no craving for these things. This is actually the process that the practice is this, you're focused and you're practicing detachment. So when the samskaras, they produce these thoughts of craving, computer craving, all things that bring the consciousness external and reinforce the identification of the soul with the subtle and gross body. So when one practices this passion, it means you have these impressions and they come to thoughts by the objects of the senses or even by one's karma. They come to vritti or thoughts. And when one doesn't entertain those thoughts by this practice, this one-pointed attention means that you're neglecting the irrational impulses, then gradually the samskaras or the latent impressions, they reduce until you come to the point where you're no longer craving for these things. And similarly, if you entertain these thoughts, then the craving or the memories of attachment for that object increase and increase and increase and increase. So it's a serious business. We're studying here yoga, but how relevant it is to any practice of spiritual life. And how do we practice vairagya? Vairagya by discrimination, by hearing and understanding the price that one has to pay for the unbridled engagement of the senses with the sense objects. And this is why you have to regularly hear. That's why there is the Yoga Sutras. That's why there is the Bhagavad Gita. You have to hold these concepts in your mind. You have to think about them, at least on this type of process of vairagya. It means it's something like this. You hear from the shastras that the fruits of sense gratification are temporary. You hear from the shastra the spiritual goals of life and the bhakti process, the main impetus for renunciation is the attachment you get for the goal of love of Godhead. And then when you have an attachment for the goal, and that attachment increases, then you see things which are not of value to your goal as anartha. Anartha means without value. They're valueless. You give them up. But anyway, whatever by discrimination, by understanding, Yeah, the path of Gan, of philosophical discrimination, that path goes by this vairagya detachment. So what is the price that you have to pay when contemplating? So you hear from the Shastra, and you hear from an authoritative source that you have faith in. It's like, hopefully, that's why people are phoning in, because you have some faith in the subject and hopefully some faith that I can transparently represent this subject. So when you hear some concept here, you're supposed to think about it and try to understand it. And when you do that, especially regularly, it's really good to hear Shastra regularly, to read a verse of Bhagavad Gita daily, to read some Shastra daily, to hear something daily. When you hear that idea and you think about it and begin to comprehend it, then what will happen is, in the course of your day, you will have opportunity to apply it, because there will be some craving for some object which in your vision will look beneficial to you. But when you actually hear and understand the Shastra would explain, and your goal is fortified, then when the thought comes out, and without some thoughtfulness, you know, the mind will tell you that this is a worthy object that will give me great benefit. If I get this money, great benefit. If I, you know, you look at the meal, if I eat, you know, two or three more sweets, it'll give whatever it is, whatever they have, the power, if I can get that position. So these are all types of cravings that are bringing the consciousness externally. But when one hears and understands, then he's supported in his dispassion, and he understands the price. And, you know, Bhagavad Gita, I think it's the 22nd verse, I forgot which chapter, I think, Yehi Sam Sparsha Jab Bhoga Dukha Yang. Pleasures are born from contact of the senses with the sense objects. They have a beginning and an end, and so they are the source of unhappiness. The wise do not delight in them, because there's duality. They have a beginning, they have an end. And the pleasure, if it is not wholesome, you enjoy to live. You don't live to enjoy. You take as much as you need. But if you take more than you need, then what happens is that pleasure, although it stimulates the senses, degrades the condition of the mind. When I went to the university, and it was the 60s, I was there. And half the time the school was closed down due to protests against the Vietnam War. That was great, wasn't it? School closed. We just closed the school down, and somehow they gave us our grades, and I think it was already March, and we just closed the school down, or April, we didn't have the last 2 months. But I remember one philosophy teacher who was a debauchee, obviously to me, because all the flirting with the pretty ladies who wouldn't come to class and would get all the good grades. He once said in class, he made a direct correlation between pleasure and happiness. And even at that time, I was just able to ask a simple question. Well, eating an ice cream cone cured depression. You know, that you can have pleasure, but if the pleasure is not wholesome, then the consciousness or the mind will move towards passion and ignorance, and will move towards misery and depression. Even if the so when one hears these things, then he understands. And in terms of dispassion, it's very interesting when the commentator Vyas discusses this. I think we have a lot of time for discussion today. He discusses that it's the attitude that is not inclined to accept or reject such objects, even when they're available. So it's an indifference. What is the rejection means that fanfare and energy, resist, sometimes indicates an attachment. The strong aversion indicates also an attachment. So he's not particularly averse, he's not particularly attached. If one becomes indifferent. So this is the way in which one restrains the mind. Focus, one-pointed attention, and detachment. Whenever and wherever the senses go to the sense objects, one pulls it back to the object of meditation. In the practice of japa meditation that most of us do, and as Prabhupada instructed, and it's there in the sixth chapter, we should meditate. If you really want to practice, you should sit up straight, and you should focus on the Ajna Chakra, that's right above in the middle of the forehead. And you should hold the neck. It's getting low here. You can hold the neck and the head erect, and one focuses, and simply when the mind wanders, he pulls the mind back. That's practice, vigor and enthusiasm to meditate, and as later will be recommended, Ishvara Pranidhan, you can worship the Lord, and worship the Lord means to chant mantras that are praising the Lord and with devotion. So your consciousness flows, you focus it on that, and as the mind wanders, we fix our mind. I guess last point, and then we'll have some discussion. It's a very interesting point here, he says, renunciation is the controlled consciousness of one who is without craving for sense objects, whether actually perceived or described in the Vedas. And the reason this is put in, and it's also put in the Bhagavad Gita, that Vedic religion became known as a practice to attain higher material spheres called swarga, and 90% of the Vedas was karma kanda, or sacrifice for religious activity to achieve a material goal. So even though it's just a super. Into less than six words, he puts it not only perceived or described, which implies the Vedas, because this was a common misconception. You really want to practice renunciation. You not only make sacrifice, you don't keep a material goal. that will not be renunciation. If you're the world is organized for sacrifice to the and without socialization. In a community, unless you're a hermit, and most people are not that renounced, without some form of socialization, which requires personal sacrifice, then one can't live peaceful enough for the higher endeavor of self-realization. So the first principle of society is people must sacrifice. But because people have material objectives, sacrifice. Cosmic arrangement where material objectives will be met by sacrifice. In other words, to encourage sacrifice among materialistic people for the purpose of socialization. Where there will be material fruits. So here, perceive, but don't keep a material objective for those things that are described in the Vedas. So I'll stop now. Are there any questions?
Yeah, Maharaj, I was just about to chime in to let you know that the last part there, your words were getting lost a little bit, you know.
Was it mostly pretty chopped up today?
No. Just this last part was like when you were describing or explaining the socialization, the socialization.
Yeah, I'm asking you a question. Was it mostly chopped up today? Because then I'm mad.
Yeah, I answered the question. I said no, only during the last part.
Gail?
Yeah. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Yeah. Mooney? Okay, one second.
Oh, yeah. Maharaj?
Yeah.
Maharaj, can you hear okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to go on a landline because I'm having problems, okay?
Okay. You mean you're going to call back in a minute?
No, I'm going to keep that on until I get on that.
Okay. So may I ask the question now, or should I wait?
You should probably wait until he gets the landline connected.
Yeah, I guess he's in here so well. Hari Bol, Gail.
Hari Bol, Mamuni. Belated happy birthday to Sophie.
Oh, thanks so much.
I remembered on the 4th.
Mooney, can you hear me?
I hear you fine, Maharaj.
Okay, I'm going to be on this now. Okay, go ahead. What's up?
So first I wanted to say I really appreciated the point that you stressed in class about trying to set some space and some time for one's sacred duties, I mean, so to speak, or one's...
Oh, yeah. You know, I didn't elaborate on that. Thank you. If I can just do asana, you know, traditionally one would have a seat. And the idea of the seat is that it would be your place for meditation. And when you're on the seat, then there's nothing else. You know, in most Indian, not most cultured Indian homes, they have a little temple room. a little meditation room. You know, some kind of sacred space is required, and one should organize his house or something as far as possible where there is some seat or space that represents only for God, only for self-realization. I know one godbrother of mine who's actually an extremely successful businessman. I mean, I think he has, you know, he had 50, 100 stores. Very expert person. And he came to India and he came to Vrindavan and his spiritual life became revised. And, you know, he spoke to some nice godbrothers who are sadhus. And he just, you know, he had his beads, his mala, by his seat. And that's where he actually, you know, chanted. Go ahead, Mooney, what else?
I just appreciate just to finish what I was saying real quick, yeah. I appreciate the reminder because I find that maybe it's just the time of life we're in and everything, but I find that just the various things that come up tend to, if they don't interrupt sadhana, they tend to encroach on it. And I appreciate your point of saying, no, there's a way we can at least, whatever we can do, we can say, all right, this is the time I'm going to donate, or I'm going to devote and stick with it. So anyway, thank you. My question was about vairagya.
Yeah.
Sometimes I find that we have descriptions that say something like this. In order to achieve some high spiritual state, you should do some practice. And then when you hear what the practice is, it already presupposes a very high state of spiritual evolution.
Yeah.
And so the definition of dispassion here was almost like the indifference of a realized soul towards the material world.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And if that's supposed to be something we do to get to a certain state, is it just that for people like us, or let's say people like me, we really just have our abhyasa or our practice, and the vairagya will happen on its own?
Uh-huh. Well, he said that practice, Vigyan Bhikshu, what's his name?
Vigyana Bhikshu.
Vigyana Bhikshu.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says practice leads to vairagya. But what I have an understanding is in some of these definitions, the goal is kind of the practice. So what is actually vairagya? Ragya means attachment and vai means without. So what is without attachment and dispassion mean? It means when you're without craving. And you're very controlled, and you're without craving for sense objects. But the practice, you know, part of the practice is practicing vairagya, you know, and that's whenever and wherever the mind goes, you pull it back, you know. So I guess in one sense, maybe... Or you can look at it, or even when you say yoga, you know, yoga is the practice, but yoga really is also means the controlled mind. So, you know, there's a yoga practice for the controlled mind. Or you can look at it is that really practice is the first stage and vairagya then comes, you know. The practice is if the practice, well, let's see if we can differentiate them, okay? So the practice is the meditation, right?
Yeah.
So it means you're focusing on one thing. Now, distracted memories, distracted thoughts are going to come up. So the vairagya is the, I guess it's part of the practice, but the
right.
Vairagya is the kind of dispassion towards them. You know, it's very close because it's also discrimination. They come out. And then one thinks, no, this will not lead to good. You know, this is just temporary. However you feel, you impose your understanding on that. You know?
Yeah, so in that sense, I mean, practice presupposes some vairagya, right? I mean, that's what it seems like you just made very clear, right? You can't have practice without vairagya because you have to try to focus the mind.
Right.
So, but I guess, yeah, so... So
I think they're interwound, interwoven, aren't they?
Seems like it.
Yeah.
So then when he says that vairagya is this high state, maybe he's just referring to a kind of high level of success in vairagya, maybe what we aim for, and some people, hopefully we in this lifetime, will attain. But obviously that can't be the only meaning of vairagya, because if that's the case, then no one would have any renunciation until they're perfected practically.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Let me just read the verses in succession and see how they sound, okay?
Okay, sure.
Okay. So the first one is, the vritti states of mind are restrained, nirodha, by abhyas, practice, and vairagya, dispassion. Of these, practice is the effort to be situated in one-pointedness of mind. Stato. It's the stato. It's to be situated in this one-pointedness of mind. So that's the practice. And practice becomes firmly established when it has been cultivated uninterruptedly and with devotion over a prolonged period of time. And I would have to say, I understand that that devotion to mean, an understanding, a reverence that you're pursuing. So, it's a reverence. It's the goal. It's the topmost goal, this realization of the innermost self, it's the topmost goal, and I cannot attain it half-heartedly or frivolously. It's the top. So practice becomes from when it has been cultivated uninterruptedly and with devotion over a prolonged period of time. And then today's verse, after defining practice, now the second element. Renunciation is the controlled consciousness of one who is without craving for sense objects, whether actually perceived or described in the Vedas. So controlled, so you're controlled, and it's just like the same. I think it's the same thing with yoga. In one sense, yoga chitta vritti is, what does yoga mean? It's to restrain the mind. So that's, yoga, basically the definition is describing the goal. But then when it attains, then when it says how to attain the goal, well, this is how you do practice. And so you basically, it's practice and of focusing the mind. And then basically it's practice of restraining it when it wanders.
Okay.
Anything else?
May I ask a
question? Yeah, please. Because I ended early, and it's good. I mean, it's better to churn it and really understand it deeply than to go too quickly.
Throughout your class, you tend to, I find that you tend to apply these things sometimes to a bhakti context to make it clear to those of us who are bhaktas, which I suppose are most of us. But I want to understand vairagya in the bhakti context, exactly,
yeah.
Specifically. And so, there's the famous verse which says that renunciation properly flows from bhakti. So you start with devotion, and vairagya is a byproduct. Janayatyasu vairagyam jnanam.
Jnanachayad ahoitakam.
At the same time, I know that Sri Rupa Goswami says a little bit of renunciation may be good for those people who can't be steady in their practice. They may need to, we might say, artificially cultivate it or something for the sake of getting grounded in their practice. So how would you suggest, those of us who are bhaktas, we are aspiring to be yogis, but our understanding is generally that vairagya flows from our development of bhakti. Do we understand these verses in the same
way? Well, first of all, what is that verse? Jnana vairagya yuktayam. What is it? What's that verse? Jnana vairagya yuktayam. What is it? You remember?
The one that I quoted, or is there a different one you're thinking?
That one you quoted.
Vasudeve Bhagavati
Bhakti Yoga Piyojita. Jnana vairagya yuktayam.
Janyati asu vairagyam.
Yeah, asu. Well, what it really means is, that verse means it's not that you just perform bhakti and automatically you become renounced, but I used to study these, and it has something more to do that. Anyway, I can't remember, but the basic concept is in bhakti is Vishyavani Vartante Niraharasidena Raso Rajam Raso Pyasya Param Drishva Nivartate, that there's a taste in your meditation. It's not just, in other words, technically speaking, yoga. It's just vairagya, basically, because you're focusing the mind, and then you're just pulling it back, and you're focusing the mind on anything, right? So you're just focusing on an object. So it's all vairagya. And I guess with the path of bhakti, there is some kind of enthusiasm and devotion to the object of your meditation. And because there's some enthusiasm and devotion to the object of your meditation, you're not actually focused on the renunciation. You're focused on the devotion, the seva. And because you're focused on the devotion, and that becomes your objective and goal, and devotion itself is attractive, then kind of almost more automatically you can become renounced. In other words, you're not focused on renunciation. There's three things. There's indulgence, there's dedication, and there's renunciation. So indulgence is basically karma. Renunciation is gyan, and dedication is bhakti. So you're not focused on giving up. You're focused on a positive activity of service and devotion. And when you have taste for that, then other things then automatically become pale in comparison. That's the basic idea. And therefore, then there's the concept of yukta vairagya, balanced detachment, because in the path of bhakti, the heart has to be soft and the heart has to be open. So the tendency of vairagya is actually to close the heart, because vai means without, renunciation. So you're approaching everything, no, no, no. So you're closing the heart to cravings, etc. But because in the path of bhakti, the heart needs to be used, then Rupa Goswami said yukta vairagya, which means you give up those things which have no value to service to God. And therefore, you know, someone in the path of... Because you have to understand, when he's talking about yoga, yoga comes after preparatory work. You know, he's talking now about this yoga chitta vritti nirodha. This is a high stage of meditation, which has somewhat of a high level of material prerequisite, as mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, celibacy, seclusion, you know, staring at the tip of your nose. So it's actually a very, very high stage. So there's a it's you know, you basically, to begin the practice or to do it properly, you already have to be a little bit aloof. So bhakti is more the path, I guess, of dedication. And when you become very, very dedicated, then naturally you become renounced. A devotee is also renounced, but he's not focusing on renunciation. He's focusing on devotion and service. So I guess it's a little bit different, but at the same time, although, you know, the devotee can, the bhakta can live in the world, and also the karma yogi can live in the world. But although he lives in the world, he still has his practice, his sadhana. And although he's trying to do his meditation with some attraction and some affection, affection is attraction, affection is pleasure, you actually have some relationship with the goal of your, the object of your meditation. Still, that's there. You know, you still have to pull the mind back. Anything else?
I could bring them up some other time.
No,
I mean,
please do. We have time.
Well, the only thing, the final thing I was wondering about was that I do find that just in line with what you were just saying, often there may be some personal habit that I'm trying to like overcome in a self-help kind of way, something like whatever thing that annoys me about my behavior or conditioning, which is a part of the part of sadhana is to overcome it, become more sattvic. And I find that when I've heard a good class or I've had it in a nice kirtan or had a nice conversation with one of my gurus or whatever, it's much easier to get the enthusiasm to overcome it. It's not as big of a burden anymore. Because I think, you know, to me that's a kind of illustration on a maybe on a lower level how bhakti naturally allows for renunciation. So that makes sense. And on the other hand, this is not a contradicting point, but I find also that there's times where maybe you can offer to God your attempts at renunciation where it's not merely jnana, but it's a kind of bhakti where it's praying to Krishna, you know, I want to show my dedication to you by trying to struggle through this. Does that make sense? Could that be a kind of bhakti, even though maybe its official form is renunciation?
In the path of bhakti, I forgot where I read it, but, you know, the idea is everything has to be offered. You know, you can go further and further and further, but even, you know, a sadhu in Vrindavan will offer the medicine.
Yeah.
There has to be, you know, there'll be some conception, you know, because the consciousness is so much to make oneself an object of God's pleasure. And therefore, focus on the desires of the divine or the pleasure of the divine therefore everything is offered to the divine because therefore, yeah, so I guess anything. I'm just trying to think a little bit more clearly. Yeah, but I think that the answer to this lies in that the path of Gyan, which yoga is. Yoga is the path of Gyan, the path of discrimination, knowledge, renunciation. The path of Gyan begins after Karma Yoga, where the path of Bhakti, one could enter into a meditational practice and still stay within the world because his conscious is not renunciation, it's dedication. So it's not just that, you know, karma means, you know, you enjoy the objects and you give the fruits to God. But in bhakti, you can stay in the world and engage with the world and directly offer everything and not be in the mood of taking anything for oneself.
You just reminded me, in a non-distracted way, I just pulled up, I don't know if this is what you were thinking of, but there's a verse in the 11th canto that says, whatever one does according to his conditioned nature, with body, speech, mind, senses, intelligence, or self, should be offered unto the Supreme, thinking this is for Sri Narayana. And Sridhar Swami comments that the regulation that one should serve the Lord does not refer only to prescribed religious paths, ceremonies, and regulations. Rather, all the activities one performs in this world according to one's personal nature should be dedicated to the Lord. I don't know, so I think...
No, I think that's something there. Yeah.
So, well, thanks, Marsh. I really
appreciate it. It was an interesting conversation. I, I just want to think a little bit more of it. It's let's see. Would anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, accept my humble obeisances.
Amiya, thank you again.
Thank you for class. Wonderful conversation between you and
okay.
Harmony.
Yeah. It's always nice that
lots of deep points. Yes.
Brings up. Thank you. Anyone else like to say hello? Star 6 should mute the phone somehow.
Sam, I just heard Krishna.
I hope it wasn't too broken up. I don't get good cell phone reception out here in Besant Falls, so,
And for the most part, it was fine for the whole class. It was just like a few minutes there before you switched over to the landline. It was getting a little choppy.
Okay, because I was having problems, like, for 2 hours before it calls was dropping. Okay. Okay. Thanks, Rati. Rati? Okay. I think I'm going to have to call you, Rati, and ask you something, because that battery came just... I'll give you a call after this. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, we'll end for today. Thank you. Don't you cope with the Lucas Jenkins.